finished up last week. We looked at Assyria. We through this study, a lot of this material, Brother Gene Taylor has put together the histories and whatnot. In his study, he took a pause in the middle and covered the world powers because of the way that they played in their influences. God's playing out His plan through them. We see God, even through His prophets, we're speaking about these things. So that's the reason that we're bringing those out and reminding ourselves of the world powers that were back then, up through this period of time that we're looking at, and still in force when the New Testament opens up. So we looked over Assyria last week. Of course, we finished when we did. You know, we reminded ourselves that Assyria, the northern kingdom, fell to Assyria. And one of the things that we noted, because it's important, is man, you see man, just like today, putting faith in coalitions. You see man putting faith in teaming up with the big guys to take care of. You see a lot of instances, even like with King Ahaz, against Isaiah's advice. He put his faith in a coalition with Assyria, while Assyria was taking the northern kingdom. The southern kingdom, Judah, suffered greatly for that. We pointed that out. Not only did it cost them a lot in tribute, these coalitions a lot of times in these cases were nothing more than a conditional surrender, more or less. They were put under guidance. They were many times, as in the instance of Judah, kingdom of Judah, they had to go under Assyrian dominance. They had to adopt a lot of their religious stuff. You see a lot of things that they suffered because of that caused this continued degradation spiritually and socially that the southern kingdom was going through at that time. Yeah, the northern kingdom fell to Assyria. We saw how God allowed that or played that out. But we see, even though the southern kingdom avoided Assyria, that coalition that they set up with them to try to avoid that, they suffered greatly because of that. It costed them quite a bit. But that's pretty much where we left off. Assyria has taken the northern kingdom. I think it's a good time now to look at Babylon. Another world power at that time. We've already mentioned Babylonia a lot because if you'll remember looking at Assyria and their history, especially their history way back, you see this continuous fight for dominance between Assyria and Babylon. You know, depending on what time you look, one may have been over the other. And of course, Assyria at one time had a 300-year dominance over Babylon. About the time of the fall of the northern kingdom, but still, you see that continued back and forth. A lot of history, as we know, in Babylonia. It was a plain, Babylonia was. It was bounded on the north by Assyria and Mesopotamia. On the east, which would be on your all's right, it was bordered by Elam. Those mountains of Elam separated them. And on the south by the sea marshes in the country Kaldu, or Chaldee, as it's known now. Therefore, that's why you see a lot referred to Babylonia as Chaldeans. And on the west, they were bordered by the Syrian desert. Babylonia is derived from the capital city of Babylonia, which was Babylon. Got a lot of history. God gives us a lot about Babylon, a lot about Babylonia. In its earliest form, this Babylonia was referred to is Shinar. If you go to Genesis 10 and verse 10, they're talking here about the descendants or the family of Ham. Now, this is not long after the flood, so we're way back. We're way, way back. It says that in the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Back up to 9, talking about Nimrod. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calneh, and the land of Shinar. That Shinar is that area that we're talking about, where Babylonia was. It's later called Chaldeans, the land of the Chaldeans. I think, look in Jeremiah 24:4. I wrote the wrong one down. It's probably somewhere around that.
Five.
It could be. Yeah, like these good figs. Yeah, it is. It's 5. Thank you, Thomas. It says, thanks, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, like those good figs, so I will acknowledge those who are carried away captive from Judah, whom I have sent out of this place for their own good into the land of the Chaldeans. We know those carried out of Jews carried out by the Babylonians, and it's referred to as the land of the Chaldeans there by Jeremiah. They're also referred to there in Ezekiel 12 and verse 13. So this Chaldean is another word for the Babylonians or for that area of Babylonia there. We know a lot of it through man's history because it was referred to as, and we've all studied in school, cradle of civilization. You hear that, cradle of civilization. Babylonia was given that title. It was watered by the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, which we know was the early history comes from. And because of that location that it had around those rivers, it was a probable site for the Garden of Eden. If you look in Genesis 2 and verse 14, it's talking about the garden there. It says, the name of the third river is Adekel. It is one of those that goes toward the east of Assyria. The fourth river is the Euphrates. So it's given credit to be a probable area of this Garden of Eden. Also, when you go over to Genesis 11, later on, after the flood, you see the Tower of Babel is mentioned there in this area. So it's a steeped in history, both what God gives us divinely and what's recorded by man as well. We know that when the Babylonian Empire was at its best, it sustained a real high population. It was a very fertile, wonderful place. We can remember that has nothing to do with Eden because we know the Garden of Eden, you know, that's no longer. But it was fertile for the mere fact that it had this great water supply, and they took advantage of that water supply, and it was able to sustain this dense population. It was covered at that time, according to history and according to record, by a lot of canals, skillfully planned. They were laid out in a pattern and regulated so that they could regulate the water supply, which made it very, very fertile. And they enjoyed a whole lot of prosperity. That's why they were so rich. Not only because of that ability to grow like they had, but they were also located right there at those rivers and able for water traffic and whatnot. The city of Babylon, within Babylonia, we read a while ago from Genesis 10, and we backed up a little bit to 9, but if you read Genesis 10 back up to 8, we mentioned Nimrod there and his these cities or this area that he puts in place. He was this descendant of Ham. He established Babylon not long after the flood. Located by the Euphrates River, as we pointed out, close proximity to this Persian Gulf. So see, everything is set up to really, really be advantageous to them as far as commerce and all their agriculture and whatnot. A lot of battles were fought for it. It's no different than what we looked at when we looked at Assyria. You know, it had peaks and valleys when it came to its dominance and its powers. It was destroyed and rebuilt a number of times. Babylon was a lot of war for control over it because of its location and its advantages that it had. Nebuchadnezzar, probably one of the more noted kings that we're familiar with or that we make association with. To put you in a year frame, about 605 to 562 B.C., which is going to be up a little bit newer. At that time, it was probably the chief city of the world. Nebuchadnezzar had built this country up to the pinnacle of the world power. The city covered an area at that time of about 200 square miles, and it was on both sides of the Euphrates. Kind of gives you an idea. A densely populated area, a city that large, a city that's densely populated, you can see how that they really, really had put a lot of work into their irrigation, into their agriculture. We see that even in the building of this great city, that they had laid out the cities in grid work, 90-degree angles to where they could get around easily. A really thought-through city. Had broad streets, had three walls around it, and they were large enough that chariots could pass on the top. So they were built for fortification. They were built for commerce, this country. You can see how Nebuchadnezzar really, really got the most that he could out of that. God was allowing him to build this great world power for the plans that God had to work through him. We know from history, both scriptural and from man, it was a beautiful, beautiful, great city, wonderful city. Be careful that we don't get caught up in thinking back that everything looked like it does now when we look back and see these uncovered ruins. They didn't live in mud bricks and all this other stuff. These were very, very opulent places. Polished marble, luster, great colors. I mean, these were really great, beautiful, beautiful cities. Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon was the place, if you remember, of the Hanging Gardens, famous to this day in man's history. Something unsurpassed. One of the seven wonders of the world. He built that for one of his Median wives. Amptus was her name. And we can read about that in Daniel 4. Well, while we're over here, let's just go to Daniel. Look at Daniel chapter 4, 28 through 30. It says, "And this came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of the 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, 'Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for my honor of majesty?'" He's speaking here of this wonderful place, worthy of world recognition and history that's recorded about it. Later on in Babylon, we know that, of course, anything that gets that great is going to decline. Don't know exactly when it completely went out of existence, probably. I know there's a reference in 1 Peter 5:13. And if you take that literally, it says, "She who is in Babylon, elect together with you, greets you, so does Mark, my son." So there's a mention of Babylon here. And if you take that literally as a town, there's a mention of it. But we know from its history and from what it was, it became a symbol, didn't it, of worldliness, become a symbol of wickedness. That's what it was really, really noted for. Look at Revelation 14, verse 8. It says, "And another angel followed, saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication." Look at 18:2. "And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird." So we know that it was a symbol of worldliness, of wickedness. It's announced its fall. Revelation's back up to 17, verse 5. Let's see. "And on her forehead a name was written, the Scarlet Woman." It says, "Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of earth." So it was a scourge. It became symbolic of the awfulness, the sin that was there. And as far as its history and its end, we know because in Isaiah 13, he foretold of the end of it that was going to come. So we know it meets its end. Look at Isaiah 13. Isaiah 13, verse 17. It says, "Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, who will not regard silver, and as for gold, they will not delight in it. And also their bows will dash the young men to pieces, and they will have no pity on the fruit of the womb." This is prophecy against Babylon through the Medes. It says, "Their eyes will not spare children, and Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited, nor will it settle from generation to generation, nor will that Arabian pitch tents there, nor will the shepherds make their sheepfolds there. But wild beasts of the desert will lie there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will dwell there, and wild goats will caper there." So we know it meant total destruction, as great as it was. Of course, we're given a whole lot more history about it. God gave us a whole lot more. But I think the best way to look at it, that's just a brief thing, the best way to look at it historically, look at it religiously, look at it socially, and then look at it politically. Just bring out some points on those, and you get a real good feel for Babylon. You'll feel like you really know her. The best way to understand when you think about Babylon seems to be broke up into two time periods. There was an old Babylonia, and then it breaks into a Neo-Babylonian or a new version. It come around 600 B.C., which is when a lot of the interaction that we're going to be looking at as far as with the southern kingdom. Looking at the ancient empire, the ancient Babylonian empire, since it's regarded as a human race, it's probably one of the most ancient empires that was in existence. In about 2000 B.C., now we went way back, 2000 B.C., Babylon then was the dominating power of the world. That's a long time back, 2,000 years. I'll spell the name of the great emperor, Hammurabi. This would have been way back about 1700 B.C. He ruled a great empire that went from that Persian Gulf to the middle Euphrates and the upper Tigris. So he had this area then. Followed about 1,000 years of struggle after him, after he brought this to that early pinnacle way back in 1700. He went into 1,000 years of struggle. controlled by the Hittites, the Kassites, the Elamites, the Syrians during this time. You remember when we were looking at Assyria, we talked about that long extended period of time where Syria and Babylon set their traded licks back and forth, one trying to get up on top of the other. That was going on then as well. But it was culminated by 300 years of this Assyrian supremacy that we looked at last week. Assyria got up on top there. The Lord brought them up to power. And they enjoyed about 300 years there as God was playing out His plan. That would have been 885 B.C. up to 607 B.C. During that time, we saw a lot of Babylonian rulers that tried to get out from under get out from under this Assyrian supremacy, to break away from them. 2 Kings 20 and verse 12 mentions one of the Babylonian kings, Merodach Baladan. And your versions, depending on if you got King James or New King James or what version that you got, you'll see variations of these names and how they were translated. But this Merodach Baladan tried to revolt from Assyria and even made Babylon independent of them a couple times. We remember him from that 2 Kings and whatnot because he visited Hezekiah in that time when Hezekiah was king of the Jews. Look at 2 Kings. Kings in verse 20. We see there about that time frame. He actually exposes the wealth of Judah by showing this off to him. And after Hezekiah's recovery from his sickness, and this would have probably been around 712. So we see this king, I think in my version, he's referred to instead of, he's Merodach Baladan instead of Merodach Baladan. You'll see different things. King James, I think, has him as Merodach Baladan. Has anybody got King James looking at that? Is it Merodach Baladan?
Verse 12, Mark, it's King James Baradach.
Yeah. Merodach Baladan, okay. Okay, because I know I looked at some of these names when I got to seeing some discrepancies, and I found in some, in King James, it'd be just a little bit different than the New King James. Same king, but they just had a little bit different name. But he visited Hezekiah. We know that story. God gave us a lot on that about 712 B.C., where the wealth of Judah was exposed to him. Sargon II of Assyria crushed these rebellions that this Merodach Baladan led. And this Sargon II Assyrian, his son, Sennacherib, we talked about him, devastated Babylon in about 689 B.C. So we see Babylon hit a bottom here under Assyria about that time. The son of this Sennacherib rebuilt Babylon, and he took Manasseh of Judah captive to Babylon. We have that story in 2 Chronicles 33:11. That would have been about 687 to 643 B.C. So we see how through this time that Assyria was oppressing Babylon, Babylonia, these kings that were there and the history of that. About this 600 year B.C. that we mentioned a while ago, we go into this Neo-Babylonian. This is when we pick up a time where we're more familiar through God's Word with Babylonia or Babylon. This Neo-Babylonian Empire, the king or credited to do that, the leader that was credited to that was Nabopolassar. He rebelled against this Assyria in 625, and he established the independence of Babylon at that time. Once again, you see this tendency to form these coalitions. He hooked up with this, I'm going to spell his name, C-Y-A-X-A-R-E-S, which was a Mede, which is important to us because we know our history's coming with the Medo-Persians. But we see this Nabopolassar hook up with this Mede, and he conquered and destroyed Nineveh, which was the capital of Assyria that we looked at last week, in about 612 B.C. He defeats the what's left of the Assyrian army at Haran in 610 B.C. 5 years later, in 605 B.C., this Nabopolassar and his son Nebuchadnezzar defeated an alliance of the Egyptians and what was left of the Assyrians at Carchemish, forever ending this Assyrian domination. So we've seen in about 600, this Assyrians are pretty much gone. They're done. That's why this Neo-Babylonian Empire is a little more important to us, because in steps Nebuchadnezzar, which we're all familiar with, which God's given us a lot of scripture and a lot of history about, he comes in about that time. He succeeds his father and was this empire, this Neo-Babylonian empire, this, they're his greatest king. We look back at the Jewish kingdom before it was divided, the United Kingdom before it was divided. We saw a great conqueror in David, didn't we? I mean, they had some, God played through David. He was a great conqueror. He swelled their boundaries to the greatest points. I mean, to the point he was not allowed to build the temple, but along came Solomon. Solomon was the building brains. He did the building. He accelerated them through that. Well, in this case of Nebuchadnezzar here with these Babylonians, he was both. He was a great emperor as far as militarily. He was great in his building. He was good in all these areas. God was raising these Babylonians up, just as we looked at last week. They've dealt with these Assyrians. They dealt their blow there. He's now using them as this world power. This Nebuchadnezzar, he captured all the territory that had once been held by that king of Egypt, from the brook of Egypt to the Euphrates River. He restored those boundaries back once again. We're told that in 2 Kings 24 and verse 7. It says, "And the king of Egypt did not come out of his land anymore, for the king of Babylon had taken all that belonged to the king of Egypt, from the brook of Egypt to the river of Euphrates." So Nebuchadnezzar's taken all this back. He invades Judah in about 605. So here comes Babylon on the scene as far as the southern kingdom goes. We know that from Daniel chapter 1, verse 1 mentions it. It says, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it." So we're up to this 605-600-year B.C. area. The Babylonia that we're familiar with here is now in effect, and Nebuchadnezzar is in Judah laying siege to Jerusalem. He invades again in 597 B.C., we're told, in 2 Kings 24:1, and he invades a third time in 586 B.C., and that's when he destroyed Jerusalem. So we see Nebuchadnezzar has came in and flew through Judah. He also besieged Tyre for 13 years. From 598 to 585 B.C. But after him, like all the others that we've looked at, it's the reason we're making a lot of these points, these other kings came in behind him, ineffective kings. Many of them ruled for different reasons, and just they never were the same. And the empire was quickly brought to his demise after Nebuchadnezzar leaves. We'll stop there because we've got more to say about Nebuchadnezzar. We've got more to say about his power, his control, how God controlled it. But next week, I want to look at Babylon just a little while longer religiously. We'll look at them socially, politically. And after that, we should be in place to maybe take a quick look at the Medo-Persians as they come in, so that we can look at this period between the Testaments and know how we got there, what came with it, what was there when the New Testament picked up that was not there when the old one closed out, and start getting a feel for how some of this stuff came about. It's a good study. Has anybody got any questions? Anything else? I'll...